I'm gonna do an oral interpretation of most, but not all, of a paper written by Gerson called Psychological Reactions on the Gerson Diet in Tuberculosis of the Lung. The reason I want to read this is that we haven't had any exposure yet in this facility, the most of us. Now, Myrna has, Jay's been around a while, and people, Ron has, but the rest of you who are relatively new to this may not be aware of how profoundly the emotional being and, in fact, the intellectual or perceptive being can be changed by not only the disease process but by the treatment. And I want you to hear this so that you can more easily relate with one another and with the staff, and so that you can more readily interpret what it is you're experiencing, all right? Psychological Reactions on the Gerson Diet, by Dr. Max Gerson, Dr. Wolfgang von Weisel, writing from Vienna in 1934 for the journal Psychotherapeutische Praxis, which is essentially practical psychotherapy. The purpose of such a brief paper cannot be to point out all the countless changes which occur in the psyche of a patient suffering from tuberculosis of the lung as the disease takes its course. It's understandable that the awareness of being physically ill also finds psychological expression. In particular, patients with cavities or those who've experienced hemorrhaging from the lungs undergo severe emotional shock. Often they try to make up for their new inferiority complexes by overcompensating. They become very demanding in their everyday lives. They go out dancing all night. They smoke behind their doctor's back. They return to work too soon, and they're tempted to indulge in sexual excesses, to go out driving in a convertible all night just to prove to themselves and everyone else that they still can. Often, patients go to the other extreme, becoming hypochondriac, taking their temperatures countless times a day, avoiding any excitement, but unfortunately also any stimulation, shutting themselves off from the rest of the world. To put it briefly, they turn into eccentrics and, in a certain sense, narcissists. The nature of the psychological developments which the individual patient will experience depends on his or her psychological predisposition. All right? Now, this is the first concept of great importance here. Psychological predisposition, we now call that conditioning. All right? And just to give verbal homage to conditioning, let me try to explain what that is by relating a couple of examples from, say, Psych 101 films of rats. All of this stuff can be seen in rats and other animals as well as human beings. Hans Selye, for example, proved that mice placed on a turntable and rotated would become very destabilized and begin to exhibit all the signs of clinical depression because they couldn't handle the stress. And that was a term that Selye coined and won the Nobel Prize for describing stress. We were shown films of rats who were thrown in a tub of water which was inescapable, high stainless steel sides, and these animals could tread water for 23 to 24 hours before succumbing and drowning. However, rats that were picked up multiple times a day by trainers and restrained against struggle until they finally gave up struggling, these rats, plucked from their cages and thrown in the water, would resign within minutes and drown, even though they were physiologically capable of swimming for 23 to 24 hours. This was a conditioning influence that resulted in learned resignation. Right? Learned resignation is obviously not going to be a big deal here. Most people who are here are seeking alternatives, which means that you haven't learned resignation, but you are, in fact, unwilling to accept the negative circumstance, and you are trying to change it by changing your own behavior or the behavior of those around you, and that's good. But conditioning can still be with us. For example, some of us were raised by tyrannical parents. If they were emotionally or physically abusive, chances are that part of our adult being still harbors an unresolved conflict, which is created when the nurturer, the child's God, becomes a punisher at the same time. All right. In other words, not a safe place, a feeling that one cannot be safe. And this can lead to problems in recognition of emotional pain. We don't want to know we're in pain because it's the only parent we've got, right? So we don't want to know that that the nurturer is hurting us. Those of us who have lost our ability to identify and track emotional pain very well, oftentimes will endure circumstances that are not suitable or appropriate for too long to negative physiological outcome. One of the best examples of a negative thing that many of us have endured is a regular 9-to-5 job in a field where our hearts aren't in it. Where we really don't want to be doing what we're doing it because we have to, because it's a survival thing. And that, especially if you've got a crummy boss who's on top of you all the time and chewing you out all the time, can result in physical disease. A study of 10,000 British social workers or people working in the socialized systems over there found that those who had the least control over their lives were most susceptible to cancer, heart disease, adult onset diabetes, and on and on and on. So being able to control or take the locus of control internally is very, very important. All right? In this medical system, you're asked to work cooperatively with the physicians, to collaborate in your own care, not to be a passive recipient of care nor a compliant soldier at the bottom of the totem pole. That isn't going to help you because it's not going to nurture fighting spirit and it's not going to help you in terms of will to live. Okay, conditioning. Conditioning is a very, very powerful influence. More about that at another time. The active, energetic person, the sexually overstimulated bohemian, oh, this is like 1934, that's a stereotype, okay? Bohemian does not mean Czech nationality, it means artistic, okay? And I know that because I'm Czech, and when I first read it, I said, whoa, what are we saying here? The ladies' man will react differently once the disease is manifest than someone who's apathetic or passive or suffering from inhibitions before becoming ill. But whatever psychological changes these various types experience after the onset of the disease, what oppresses them most is the awareness of constant danger, the supposedly incurable nature of the disease. So it's understandable that the attitude of all these patients changes completely as soon as they feel able to believe that not only can their disease be healed, it must certainly be healed. You have a list? Okay. I have something over here that I'm going to put a bookmark in the talk for a second. I'm going to hand some things out here. We have something for a few people. Let's see. Myrna. These are all large and you can wear them as nightgowns. Okay. Myrna gets an I Survived Coley's Toxins t-shirt. Robert, where are you? In the back behind the telescope. There you are. All right. Now, these are from the original lot, which means that you've got a combination printed and hand-corrected shirt. The typesetter wrote Toxia, Coley's Toxia. And let's see, Marianne, where are you? She's in HBO, okay. Jay gets one. Okay. And, oh, Ron. Ron, you get one. All right. These are the Coley's Toxins t-shirts. Now, once in a while, Rogers even wears his into the ICU to give the stuff, and I like that. For those of you who haven't seen them, this is what they look like. I Survived Coley's Toxins. It's an Olympic medal, right? An Olympic medal. All right. That's right, so far. Still alive. All right. Constant danger. Just a tiny bit about the mechanism of what it is that makes us depressed when we think we're going to die. Now, that shouldn't really require a lot of explanation. Having been there, I can tell you that a certain amount of conditional reactive depression is understandable. You've had a life, now you don't have a life anymore. Disease has interrupted you, blown your life off the stovetop and everything else to the back burner, and now you're setting surrogate goals. Those are medical goals instead of your life goals. All right, so you have a reason to be depressed, but there's a real physiological change in brain chemistry that occurs when that sense of interruption is complicated by actual anxiety and fear of death, and the sense that one is going to die, which is engendered, obviously, by many times by the medical consultation that you have when you're given a prognosis and treatment plan. All right? Now, awareness of constant danger is something that has been studied. The birth of Prozac, the first drug ever to slice through clinical depression in a population of people that I think are very particularly interesting, in other words, psychotherapists themselves, who had been in analysis and therapy for 20 years or 30 years or more, found that taking Prozac was the first time that they ever got relief from the depression, that all of their coping skills and cognitive therapy work and analytical work had not helped them to cure the depression, but suddenly they were no longer depressed. People who were not able to engage in meditation and prayer were all of a sudden able to meditate and pray because the depression stopped. Now, what stopped? When Prozac is given, what stops? Well, it's very simple. We have a relaxation neurotransmitter called serotonin, which is manufactured in part from tryptophan in our bodies. All right, tryptophan, which has been made illegal by the Food and Drug Administration. Apparently, they like us anxious. I can tell you that I spent a day at the Food and Drug Administration. It's one of the worst experiences of my life. It's a gray world, a very gray bureaucratic world. Serotonin will circulate normally in the cerebral spinal fluid and bathe the brain and pass through the brain tissues, and we will be in a state of what is called relaxed wakefulness. Relaxed wakefulness. However, when anxiety and fear are present, our serotonin becomes attached to receptor sites which take it out of circulation for a purpose, and that is to allow the fight or flight response so that we get blood to the extremities, higher heart rate, we're ready physiologically, our muscles are primed. That fight or flight state is essential to survival of any species. All right. It can be seen, for example, that angelfish placed across a glass wall from a predator fish will, after a period of time, have almost no circulating serotonin. It will all be locked at association sites. Chimpanzees in a hierarchical tribe who are not dominant, male chimps who are on the low level of the dominance order, will have very little free-floating serotonin. All right, the relaxation neurotransmitter is locked up and therefore cannot tell the body, you must chill, right? To be in the vernacular about it. We have to relax, we have to breathe in order to be able to heal. All right, relaxation and breathing is not possible when we're filled with the symptoms of fear, and the symptoms of fear are created by the fight or flight physiological response, the loss of serotonin in circulation. Prozac, Zoloft, and all of these other successful drugs were developed first by Eli Lilly Company studying the serotonin binding phenomenon, and they are in effect serotonin reuptake inhibitors. They prevent the locking up of serotonin. And this explains physiologically, for the first time in the history of the study of affective disorders, at least why people with that type of depression couldn't just relax, because a long-term locking of serotonin results in a permanent stasis at that new level. All right, or at least we can call it a reversible stasis, but one which will hold. You know, when you give chimpanzees in the lower end of their hierarchy Prozac, that they stop responding with fear signals and the dominant chimp loses his position in the roost? Because he needs to see that everyone else is afraid of him. And if they stop reacting to him with fear, he becomes, in fact, anxious himself. All right? So this is the mechanism. Now, anybody who has been diagnosed with a terminal disease will have had the opportunity to experience the fight-or-flight syndrome, because although Gerson says nobody in their right mind would ever tell someone you're going to die, medical ethics today demand that you be told you're going to die. All right? The physician is not allowed to withhold that information from you. It's not the doctor's fault. This was set in place by the Office of Protection of Research Risks at NIH, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Office of Medical Ethics, all right? This is where that's coming from, and what it means is that when you walk into a doctor, the doctor's going to tell you, you're going to die on a timeline, it's going to hurt, nothing we will do will stop it. Now, we have some treatment options for you. All right? What does that do to the individual? All right. In my own experience, and I'll be a little bit liberal with this and use some artistic license. In 1977, I got a call from a medical secretary that I'd been hearing from for months at the University of Minnesota Medical Center. I was going in for systemic lupus erythematosus, and there was some concern now because I had been urinating clear fluid instead of yellow urine for a while. And I was seeing a new group of people, not just rheumatologists, but nephrologists. And now the medical secretary called me up one day and said, oh, and by the way, I've got bad arthritis in all of my joints and sores all over my body, all sorts of angiomatosis in the cheeks and a butterfly rash across the bridge and those usual crap, high ANA titer. And I was feeling awful and losing weight and just not having a good time of it. Responding very badly to prednisone. And I remember the call from the secretary because she said the doctor has test results and would like to talk to you about them. And I asked, as I always asked, anything bad? And this time I didn't get an answer. I'd always gotten an answer which was nothing out of the ordinary. But this time I got, I'm sorry, the doctor will have to tell you. Well, I went immediately into a state of pseudo-panic. They said they wanted to see me Thursday. It was a Tuesday. I said, I'll be there bright and early Thursday morning. They said, not this Thursday. The doctor's out of town and you can't see him until next Thursday, right? So now I've got 9 days with this new knowledge that my tests are bad and I've got to go see the doctor to find out. And so walking around, the walking worried, right? The worried well, as the AIDS activists call the people that haven't come down yet with AIDS. Right? But I was already sick and I was worried like crazy. And you know what it does when you worry? I mean, you can't eat. Your stomach gets really weird. I remember I had gotten so worked up by the time I got on the freeway to drive there 9 days after I got the call that my mouth was completely dry and my palms were sweating. My temples were burning hot and my feet were freezing cold. Right? Anybody been there? Yeah. Oh, guys, I've been there and done that. I got there in time, and I found a parking place, and I went in. I thought, this is fantastic. I got a parking place. I'm going to make my 1 o'clock. I got in, and, of course, the doctor was 2 hours behind. So I had to go to the waiting room. And I got to tell you, there's nothing worse for an anxiety state than the waiting room. I went to see a play called The Waiting Room. Actually, I went to be on a symposium board with Susan Love from UCLA she does the breast cancer clinic there. And Lisa Loomer had written this play. The Mark Taper Forum was doing it. And we had this symposium, this medical board, after the play. First question, somebody said, why'd you put it in the waiting room? And Lisa Loomer said, well, originally, since I'm Catholic, I was going to put it in limbo, but I thought nobody would understand. It's too obscure. So then I thought maybe I'll put it in hell. But hell seems so graphic and Dante-esque that we decided on the waiting room. And both Dr. Love and I said at the same time, what's the difference? Right? What's the difference between hell and the waiting room? When you're in the waiting room, what happens is, this is the artistic license, Orson Welles' film crew comes in and redoes the doctor's office. Last time you were there, he had just the regular old credenza, and he sat behind it, and you had a nice lounge chair you could sit in, and there was lighting and some modern art on the wall, and it was okay, a lot of degrees hanging there. But this time when you walk in, he's backlit, the light is glaring at you, and all you see is shadows, and there's a curling trail of cigarette smoke diabolically fuming over the top of his head. And somebody's elevated his desk, so he's looking down at you, and you feel very small, and it's all black and white, and there's a stereo reverb unit, so that he says, come in, come in, come in, come in, come in. I'm sorry, 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 sorry. Bad, bad news, 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 news. And what you get is an altered state of consciousness, all right? You are in a symbolically loaded environment where all of that programming from watching man, woman, birth, death, infinity, Dr. Casey and Dr. Kildare, all of that is now going to extract from you an emotional response that's going to be core in your being, all right? You're going to respond from your viscera. And the doctor is going to tell you, you will die on a timeline. It's going to hurt on the way down. There is no cure. We can make it hurt less. When the doctor was done with me, I couldn't sleep. I called a friend. I went on a couple of good binges, brandy and beer. Smoked way too many Marlboros. Night after night, rather than go home, I went out and did that. Until I began to feel too crummy to keep doing it. Coming off of that, I would awake at 3 a.m. in fear of dying, drenched with sweat, without a sense of why I felt I was dying. It was just fear of dying. It was as real as anything can be. It took me forever to figure out that only the one physician had told me I was going to die. One physician said, you're going to lose it. One physician said, you're going to die. But that had become incorporated into my being as an almost auto-suggestive tape loop underneath. And as much as I would try not to look at it, that fear would come bubbling up and I would wake in the middle of the wee hours of the morning afraid of dying. All right? How do you get rid of that? What we're talking about is a number of effects, a number of physiological effects. The opposite of this effect, placebo, faith, hope, will to live, and the fighting spirit. And look at the number down there at the bottom. Estimates regarding the role of placebo in medicine attribute from 30 to 70% of all positive medical outcomes to the placebo effect. What is it? The placebo effect is your body coming alive. All right? It is believing it's possible to get well. Believing it's possible. Hoping that it's going to happen. This is the other side of that coin. The nocebo. Interestingly, while we were in Montreal, Jean-Claude Rodet, who's a naturopath up there, showed us a book that's written on nocebo. An entire book. Unfortunately, it's in French, and this is not one of my languages. Oh, by the way, Mr. Thistles, we found a book on Joseph, also in his library in French. We'll show it to you. They gave us a copy. In the nocebo effect, what we have is an authority figure delivering a bad prognosis when you are susceptible. Now, I don't know what's more susceptible than having to wait 9 days being told the tests are bad, and you go in to see the doctor and wait another 2 hours in the waiting room, and then the doctor tells you, and he's in a stainless steel and ceramic palace dressed in white vestments, what Robert Mendelssohn said the clergy of modern medicine wore. And, you know, they use the holy water, silver nitrate into the baby's eyes because they figure the mother lied about not having syphilis. And, you know, vaccines to prevent you from being ill. These are the holy waters of the modern medical church. And so we go in and we've got this background of Marcus Welby, Ben Casey, and Dr. Kildare. And now this person that should be able to fix our broken bodies and send us back to wellness tells us, oops, not you. You're so broke, I can't fix you. You're going to die. All right? This nocebo effect is caused by a dissociation phenomenon. Does anybody know what dissociative disorders are in here? Let me give you an example of a dissociative disorder. Sybil, the young woman who was multiple personality because of sexual torture as a child. Almost all true cases of multiple personality were sexual abuse cases in childhood. Another case of dissociative disorder is the post-traumatic stress disorder recognized as the Vietnam veteran's illness. All right? The Vietnam vet's illness. What was it caused by? The Vietnam vet, let's say Joe, who's right out of high school, goes to Nam to the rice paddies, and he's supposed to hit a village, let's call it My Lai. And on the way to the village, his buddy steps on a mine and is blown to bits. Already that's too much, and Joe is going to have nightmares for months over this. But walking into My Lai and seeing that our strike was effective only in killing women and children, and that Charlie got away, there were no Kong in the village, is also too much to bear. So the conscious mind represses this. And Joe's not going to look at this again. He's not going to look. He's not going to think about it. He's going to get real superficial and talk about the weather and other things like that. Have you noticed, by the way, how there's no small talk here? Nobody talks about the weather here. Isn't that a relief? Finally, no small talk. When Joe gets home, he gets the GI Bill. There's no ticker tape parade, but somebody earnestly tells him, get an education on the GI Bill, raise a family. So he gets married after going to college, and he has a kid. And one day, even 4 or 5 years after they've had the baby, she comes home from childcare, from daycare, with a kid at 5 o'clock at night, because she gets off work at 4:30, and he gets off at 5:30, but his car's already there, in the driveway, at an angle. And the front door is ajar. And she walks in to find him with his face buried in his hands. He's sobbing. There's a baseball bat between his feet. He's just broken the living crap out of every piece of glass in the house. And he's saying, I don't know why. It was like I was watching myself. I don't know what happened. Well, you get him into cognitive therapy, and he remembers Vietnam. He remembers Pete's legs getting blown off. He remembers the man crying out for help and dying. He remembers Milai. And he can eventually decompress this. How do we do that with a bad prognosis? What do we do when our doctor has created the terrible input that has to be repressed? Well, the one thing that's true for both forms of this kind of dissociative disorder is we have to remember, put the members back together. We have to recall this. Now, what I used to do was I imagined my doctor dressed as Bozo the Clown, all right, just to diminish his effectiveness. And then I would have him say to me, Mr. Hildenbrand, look, everybody with your disease that we treat dies, so we're obviously very, very bad at it and don't know what we're doing with it, so you should go somewhere else, anywhere else. We don't know where to send you, but please don't stay with us because you deserve better. And with that, I managed slowly to deprogram the feeling that I was truly going to die. It didn't hurt either when I met a few people who said, you can get well. It's possible to get well. And the message was so counter to the death message that I found myself breathing from the belly again. And I thought, hey, this is pretty good. I'm like having a religious experience because somebody gave me permission to live. Right? And that's really what it's about. It's about an internal permission to go ahead and live. Otherwise, we can't go. We can't try. We have to give ourselves permission to heal. All right? We have to take back the authority from the medical hierarchy and put it here where it belongs, internal. The locus of control belongs in the individual. That's where the fighting spirit and the will to live really is, okay? Now, I'm not going to get all the way through this, and we're going to leave you cliff-hung until Thursday, but I'm going to finish this first section of the paper. I feel like I have so much I want to tell you about and so much we need to cover, and I've been gone for 2 weeks, and none of this has been covered during that time. All right. The conviction that the patient can and must be healed is transferred from us to our patients. Doubtless some of the astonishing success of our therapy in patients with tuberculosis of the lungs results in part from the fact that we absolutely never regard any case of tuberculosis of the lung as hopeless right from the outset. That doesn't mean that we simply don't admit to the patient that it's hopeless. No physician could be capable of such cruelty. Maybe so in the 30s, huh? But that we ourselves are so convinced that our therapy provides us with such an effective weapon, even in the most desperate cases, that whether the patient survives or not in any individual case depends on how we perform as physicians. That the patients are quick to sense this conviction, it gives them new strength and the will to live. All right? The will to live. Whenever the patient's will to live and recover is successfully roused, there is a chance of success. Where that proves impossible, even the diet therapy will fail. In my recently published book, this is Gerson talking about diet therapy for lung tuberculosis, which had 50 cases, the same model used as in the cancer therapy monograph, only a much better written monograph because at that time Gerson had research support and extended laboratory support and so on. In my recently published book, case 45 was Albert Schweitzer's wife, by the way, Helena Schweitzer. cured of a bilateral lung tuberculosis. Cases are cited where death became inevitable, although the diet had been carefully followed, because patients, all of them typically women in unhappy marriages, did not want to go on living. The patient's will to live is decisively important in diet therapy in cases of tuberculosis of the lung. You don't have to leave tuberculosis of the lung as the disease there. We play disease of the week with that. You can switch any pathology for diet for tuberculosis of the lung and still be accurate as long as you've been told you're going to die, the disease is going to shorten your life, it's going to hurt you. Also, Gerson very appropriately observed that when you're dealing with a bland and unfamiliar diet with no salt, no meat, no milk, no nicotine, no coffee, tea, vinegar, pepper, etc., and the need to eat large amounts, to take regular doses of then cod liver oil and other medications, and to drink large quantities of juice made from raw fruit and vegetables, 1.5 to 2 liters a day, where you're on 3 liters. In other words, where it's the appetite that counts, the patient has to want to recover. The physician can prescribe the cure, but it's the patient who has to see it through. That's why Leek is right when he emphasizes the value of psychological influence in diet therapy in cases of tuberculosis of the lung. The physician's will to heal must be directed with fanatical force toward boosting the patient's will to live to a maximum. Then and only then will it be possible to reverse the psychological changes in the tuberculosis patients and thereby create a precondition for further progress toward recovery. I hope you got the impact there, or the impression that was intended by the author, which is that if you haven't cooked those seeds, the emotional and mental baggage that we carry, you may be impeded in your efforts to heal. All right, and that's very, very understandable. If you're still in that mode of thinking, I'm going to die, and that's a reflex thought that just pops up every once in a while throughout the day, just walking down the hall and whammo, oh God, I'm going to die. If that's happening to you, those seeds need more work. All right, because every time that hits you, it destabilizes virtually everything about the central nervous system, the endocrine system, and the immune system, all of which are interrelated and affect one another. All right. I'm going to put a bookmark in this one. I'm going to conclude with a few remarks that are generic. Depression has many faces. As you'll hear when we finish this paper and move into the mechanisms of therapy, it is exceedingly common for people who are ill and depressed to externalize. And believe me, if you are a companion to a patient, we have a developmental t-shirt, we'll be bringing some of these down soon. Companion, and the definition of that, person going for sainthood in this lifetime. If you are a companion, you will find that when your patient goes into psychological or emotional crisis, that you will get both barrels of the shotgun aimed and fired at you. It will be your fault. All right? It's not unlike transition in labor. How many of you women have delivered? Okay, at least some of you are going to know what we're talking about. Bill Cosby put it this way. He said, my wife went into transition in the labor room and she stood up in the stirrups and announced to the entire staff that my parents hadn't been married. Right? Transition and the emotional changes, the not neurotic or psychotic changes, but near clinical psychotic changes happen with fever and with activity from the immune system. It's like a chronic infection exhaustion syndrome. All right? It's very common for people to yell at their companions, you did this, you did that, you did this wrong, you did that wrong. It's very common for the medical staff to hear that it's their fault that the disease is growing rapidly because they didn't come in on Sunday, they didn't get stuff there within 10 minutes of the time it was requested. You will hear it again and again and again. Do not be off-put by people who are venting here, all right? Venting is a way of decompressing that terribly high-energy negative experience. I did see you, Myrna, by the way.
I know that.
Just is something to add? Okay. The correct handling of somebody who's in deep crap like that is to listen to them. Ask them for more information. Ask them to repeat themselves. Ask them for a greater explication of what it is that's burning them up inside. Because the second that you say, don't worry, we'll take care of that, I've got a solution for that, they will hear that as they are done talking to me. They don't want to listen to me anymore. All right? If you're depressed, you don't want solutions. All right? So if you're a companion of a depressed person, of a person who's really in a dark night of the soul, for heaven's sake, don't tell them, we'll do this, this, and this, and fix it, and be done with it. Because what you've done then is stopped the communication. You see, never stop the communication. Keep it going. All right? Keep it going. But that's just a caution. And now, let me point out to you, too, that we're dealing with tough territory here, okay? We're dealing with, as I said, disease as an interruption of your life. Okay, I'm going to put these up here. This is where we're going to end for today with the last series of thoughts. Disease is an interruption because you lose the preferred continuity and choice in your life. All right? Disease is a command performance. It's able to address you. It says, Myrna, whatever you're doing, stop it. You pay attention to this now. Right? Forget what you were doing. You have to deal with the disease. You may not relax your vigilance. All right? Talk about a way to get uptight. That's the way it goes. The disease makes you hypervigilant. Hypervigilance is another name for the phenomenon which causes fight-or-flight syndrome, the anxiety that causes serotonin, our relaxation neurotransmitter, to be locked up in attack position so that our bodies will tense. All right, instead of our preferred continuity and choice, we have surrogate goals and aspirations. In place of family, business, and pleasure are substituted medical goals related to the disease. Talk about a downer. All right? It's what happens. Surrogate goals and aspirations. Complicating this is the isolation abandonment syndrome inevitable to serious disease. Illness causes a loss of life-giving stimulation in a number of ways. In the first place, we ourselves as patients tend to withdraw from our normal activities and social contacts due to feelings of physical disability or deformity. All right? In lupus, you get those funny, weird rashes and swollen joints and leaky sores all over your body. In cancer, you might have bumps growing and you're not fitting your clothes the way you used to, and your skin color changes and your hair gets weird. So we end up with feelings of inadequacy, helplessness, and shame. And when family members and friends and acquaintances start to see the disease instead of us, they add to the pain and the isolation and the abandonment. All right? Is there anyone here who has not lost a friend or a relative, at least lost contact because of the disease? I didn't think so. Hospitalization tends to make the isolation abandonment syndrome worse. That's why this facility insists, if it is all possible, that you come with someone you trust and love. Or, like Myrna, just stay here and move in. Get to make everybody family, you know? Patients surrender their locus of control to a hierarchy. Doctor, fix me. All right? We lose our choice. And we again feel inadequate, helpless, and ashamed of what we have become. And when we're separated from family by hospitals that establish visiting hours, that adds to the isolation abandonment. Right? It really is a team effort to get well. It really is helpful to team up. If you are here alone, don't be solo. In the dining room, sit down with people and inflict your presence upon them. In other words, make use of the people that are here in the trenches, in the foxholes with you. All right? This is where I'll leave you. All right? This admonition. This is what must be done. Yeah, you're sick. But you got to get off of the sickness kick. And yes, it's been getting worse and worse and making you feel less and less like you can possibly turn it around. But when you leave here, you're going to be physically turned around to a great extent. And you will be on your way out of that black hole. And what you can do to speed up your healing is to rediscover your hopes and aspirations. You know that what inspires you makes everything work better? For example, Harvard graduate students exposed to a 15-minute film of Mother Teresa and her work measured noticeably higher on immunological profiles after the film than before the film. All right, blood immune profiles are enhanced by things that make you feel. All right, feel. Remember when Dave Gilmore for Pink Floyd wrote, "I've become comfortably numb"? Many of us dealing with pathologies try to go there, to that place of comfortably numb. We try to numb out. But we have to come back into our feeling sentient beings in order for healing to be stimulated, move forward. Fit your treatments into the corners of your life. Do not be a slave to dogma or anxiety. Now, when you come away from here, oh, by the way, I'll spend a whole talk. I got about 5 or 6 of these talks. And I'll spend a whole talk on how in the world you can take this darn diet therapy home and fit it into anything other than your whole life. All right? And you can. And the data support that not only can you, but you should. All right? We want you to be able to make it portable. We want you to get out, go to La Boheme or to a New York Knicks game. But anything but stay locked inside the cabin and getting cabin fever and resentment, okay? Go to a ball game, to the opera, back to school, or back to work. Some people cannot function unless they're able to get their fingers in to their work. All right? I'm one of those. The worst thing that happened to me with my disease was that I couldn't think straight, and thinking was how I made my living because I was a playwright at the time. Working on an NEA writer-in-residence grant for a theater company in Minneapolis. And I couldn't work. And it was the most demoralizing thing I'd ever experienced. Of course, working in the theater is oftentimes very, very inspiring. Now, if you're digging ditches, you have to like digging ditches, right? In order for that to be inspiring. But many people have found the work they want to do. Because it's a free country, we have choice. So if you wanted to be a CPA and you're not able to manage your numbers, you're probably going to go nuts, right? Go back to school. School is one of our aspirations. Learning is an aspiration. But for Ron, it's get back to that keyboard and start composing. You know, it's getting into what really makes you feel alive. And that's why we say breathe in life and go for it. It will boost your immunity. What inspires you, right? You know that the word for breathing out is exhalation, but the word for breathing in is inspiration. Inspiration, and we just want to remember what we're about is turning it around, getting out of the rut, and getting well. That's what this trip is about. It's not only doable, but it's really right in front of you. All right? It's on the plate. And if you think I'm cheerleading, you're darn right. Because I've seen it happen. And I've seen it happen in people who were too weak to sit in this room. Too weak to get out of bed. So that's it for today. When we come back, we'll have some very clear examples of how the fever state and the heightened immune reactivity of patients in healing reactions results in depression and semi-psychotic episodes. We'll talk also about the periodicity of healing reactions, about how you can learn to predict that these things will come along with your menstrual cycle if you're women, and you'll find, if you're men, that you have monthly hormonal cycles too, which govern inflammatory reactions. And we'll get into tons and tons of technical stuff. So let me remind you once again, please bring pencil and paper. You'll be able to catch keywords. Please get the tapes. Read the primers that you've been given, the educational materials. Feel free to call the Gerson Research Organization for more information. What we know is that people tend to adhere to therapies better when they understand why they're doing what they're doing, and that knowledge creates a more potent person. All right, so that's what this exercise is about. That's why we come here. That and the fact that if I don't come and talk to you guys, I forget where I came from. I started as a medical consumer. I started in the trenches. And if I ever lose contact with people who are starting out, and I've done that a couple months at a time, it's amazing how rapidly you ivory tower. You lose the urgency. You lose that feeling of immediacy. So that's why, you know, it's a personal thing. Or as Schweitzer said, those who bear the mark of pain are never truly free, for they owe a debt to those who still suffer